Hi, this is Matthew Craig. Welcome to the Allegheny Front. In the last 20 years, more American women have died from breast cancer than all the Americans killed in World War I, World War II, the Korean War, and the Vietnam War combined. On the eve of the 14th annual Race for the Cure, we'll see what environmental links there might be to breast cancer. We'll check in with a modern parable about the beast in the garden. Some thought it extinct, but for the first time since 1944, we have a confirmed sighting of an ivory-billed woodpecker. And our organic gardeners are pruning hydrangeas. That's all coming your way, but first, let's check in with the Allegheny Front News Desk. So joining us now to update us on the news of the week is our weekly news analyst, Lisa Ann Pinkerton. Welcome, Lisa.
Thanks, Matthew.
An interesting study was released last week concerning Pittsburgh's unique asset, which is our many hillsides. Mm-hmm. Rather than developing the hillsides further, the study suggests using zoning to strengthen hillside protections for neighborhoods. So, Lisa, who commissioned this study?
The city of Pittsburgh and the Department of City Planning called for the study, and it took about a year of research, and the city council's Hillside Steering Committee conducted it. Ecological experts from Carnegie Mellon University and representatives of the Allegheny Land Trust and also architects from Perkins Eastman in Pittsburgh were also involved.
What are the attributes of Pittsburgh's hillside that the study wants to see preserved?
The study says Pittsburgh's undeveloped hillsides provide a variety of sustainable economic benefits. It suggests that when densely wooded slopes are kept in a natural condition, they can help maintain our air quality as plant life takes in carbon and releases oxygen. And trees can help abate the heat-generating effect that cities have on the climate. And local forests can enhance adjacent property values, reduce stormwater runoff, and, of course, help stabilize the soil from erosion.
I'm glad you brought up the erosion protection aspect, because it's because of that danger that citizens of the city enjoy the very large Schenley and Frick parks. Mm-hmm. They noted a majority of trees on the steep hillsides were native species. What else did they point out?
Ecologists from CMU said some forests are large enough to have what's called an interior forest patch. And this means there are at least 100 meters of buffer around the central core of the forested area. And these patches of interior forest provide special habitat for certain animal species that require solitude and very large areas to roam. And when gathering data, ecologists found trees in excess of 3 meters, which is pretty big. And then I'm not bringing this last point up to alarm anybody, but I just thought it was neat. They also discovered evidence of black bear within the city limits.
I wonder if he's paying property taxes. Anyway, the Hillside Steering Committee feels strongly that adequate protection of the slopes cannot occur with a single strategy. So they are recommending a combination of techniques. What are some of the policies they would like to see implemented?
First, they want the process of mapping Pittsburgh to be expedited, and they also recognize that developing on a slope is desirable because of the fantastic views. So they want the city to consider a flexible lot size approach that respects the slope of the land when development is proposed. Also, providing regulations to encourage cluster development can help minimize site impact and preserve open space. And finally, they'd like to see development prohibited on slopes with a grade greater than 40% and establish protections for highly visible slope hillsides because they provide a very distinctive backdrop that they think is very important to the city's image.
And before we go, Lisa, I want to let our listeners know about some news concerning the Allegheny National Forest. The Forest Management Plan is up for review, and a controversial proposal to expand wilderness and limit activities in the forest won the support of the Regional Sierra Club last week. What's involved with this plan?
Well, this plan is called Allegheny Wild, and it's a wilderness plan from the Allegheny Defense Project. It would designate around 50,000 acres of the Allegheny National Forest as wilderness, cease logging, and phase out oil and gas drilling.
What kind of support besides the Niagara Sierra Club does it have?
30 organizations and more than 700 individuals support the plan, and it's one of three wilderness plans on the table for the National Forest.
What are the other two proposals?
The other wilderness expansion proposal is by Friends of the Allegheny Wilderness, and it identifies 8 parcels with 4,000 more acres than Wilderness Wild for wilderness designation, and the Pennsylvania Native Plant Society endorses this second plan.
And the third plan?
Oh, the third plan is a no-action proposal. It would make no additions to the 9,000 acres now designated as wilderness. And this course is favored by the two local schools, the municipality, and the timber industry. A pro-timbering group, the Allegheny Forest Alliance, says that wilderness expansion will not help the local economy.
The forest management plan for the Allegheny National Forest will be up for public comment this June, so we look forward to bringing you any new developments. Thank you, Lisa, for bringing us this news.
You're welcome, Matthew.
With news analyst Lisa Ann Pinkerton, I'm Matthew Craig, and you're listening to The Allegheny Front. More American women died of breast cancer in the last two decades than the number of Americans killed in World Wars I and II and the Korean and Vietnam Wars. To turn the tide, athletes and concerned citizens run and walk the Susan G. Komen Breast Cancer Foundation's Race for the Cure. This Sunday marks Pittsburgh's 14th annual race. Race organizers, researchers, and health professionals are teaming up too. They're searching for answers about environmental links to breast cancer. The Allegheny Front's Jennifer Shveta-Jordan has this report.
Race for the Cure, this is Debbie.
These last days before the Race for the Cure, the Squirrel Hill office fields calls about race day parking and t-shirt pickup. A few weeks ago, Pittsburgh race director Joanne Meyer was having more substantial conversations about whether cosmetics or contaminants in air and water could contribute to breast cancer.
I was surprised when I made contacts with many of the women who call us for educational materials that so many of them were actually really concerned about environmental issues in their area.
Meyer brought concerned women from rural areas to the Conference on Health and the Environment in Pittsburgh. The April conference introduced scientists to activists, doctors, and others in health or environment work. The Breast Cancer Fund participated too. It's a California organization working to identify and eliminate preventable causes of the disease. It says that even accounting for genetics and other known risk factors, up to half of breast cancer cases are unexplained. Advocates like Meyer suspect environmental factors.
More and more women are getting breast cancer. In the 40s, it was 1 in 20. It's 1 in 7 today. While we see the list of risk factors, we all feel, what else could there be? Why this increase? Why this almost epidemic of breast cancer?
Race for the Cure organizer, the Komen Foundation, is also looking into environmental links to breast cancer. It's paid the Silent Spring Institute to study pesticide exposure, personal care and household products, and tap water contaminated by household wastes. Once race day is over, Meyer will develop a leadership group to target environmental issues and educate women, particularly in underserved areas. She'll get information and advice from the University of Pittsburgh Cancer Institute's Center for Environmental Oncology. The center is evaluating whether using certain makeup or hair creams is a risk factor for breast cancer. One project takes researchers into African-American salons.
To moisturize her scalp, I use olive oil, extra virgin, like the kind you cook with. And to moisturize her hair, I use...
Stylist Maria Kent quickly separates and twists sections of a woman's short hair. At the Natural Choice Salon in Oakland, Kent fashions dreadlocks with chemical-free products to protect hair follicles. There may be greater reasons to avoid products that black women have used for decades.
We realized that, maybe in these products is excess levels of hormones, and hormones do lead, and certain estrogen do lead to development of breast cancer.
Center for Environmental Oncology researcher Maurice Randall is cataloging hair care products used by black men and women. His work is based on discoveries by an Army pediatrician who noticed 18 to 24-month-old black girls developing breasts and pubic hairs. Randall says the pediatrician found the children's mothers were rubbing their toddlers' heads with a hormone-laced hair cream.
So he took the children off the hair care products, and the pubic hairs and the breasts subsided.
As an African-American woman under age 40, stylist Maria Kent is twice as likely to develop breast cancer as white counterparts. Kent's family history also includes breast cancer.
Like, my grandmother died of breast cancer. And, when I was 16, I actually found a lump in my breast, my right breast.
Kent already talks to clients about self-checks for breast lumps and mammography. Randall believes that when more is known about hair care products, Black stylists will share that information too. Next week, the Center for Environmental Oncology will post a list of questionable products on its website, environmentaloncology.org. This includes cosmetic ingredients the World Health Organization has called carcinogenic. Center Director Deborah Davis stresses that the goal is not to alarm women.
We think people have a right to know what we don't know. And when you go and purchase something, you assume it's safe or it wouldn't be in cosmetics.
Davis admits this is not the world's greatest environmental problem, but is easily addressed. Harder to avoid is what the nonprofit Breast Cancer Fund calls the most well-established environmental cause of the disease, radiation. Exposure from 1950s nuclear testing and CT scans used since the 70s parallels the breast cancer increase. Even mammography, used to detect breast cancer, employs radiation. The Breast Cancer Fund says more research is needed, but the National Cancer Institute spends just 1 of every 9 breast cancer research dollars on environmental links. Davis foresees greater challenges.
The budget cuts that are coming now for the National Institutes of Health will have a profound effect throughout the system of basic research, and it seems likely to have even a greater effect on research on environmental issues.
Davis promotes precaution about behaviors or products with unknown effects. Since exercise can deter cancer, she'll lace up the running shoes in Schenley Park on Sunday.
We will have a team, of course, from our Center for Environmental Oncology. We practice what we preach.
For the Allegheny Front, I'm Jennifer Shveta Jordan.
David Barron joins us now. He has reported on science and environmental issues for National Public Radio for more than 15 years and has written for the Boston Globe and Outside. He is a 3-time recipient of the American Association of Science Journalism Award, and he has a book called The Beast in the Garden, A Modern Parable of Man and Nature, which is published by Norton. So we thought it would be lovely if we could start with a little clip from the book, and here is David Barron.
Thank you, Matthew. I think I'll just read from the opening of the book. My book opens on January 16th, 1991, in Colorado, the small town of Idaho Springs, which is west of Denver in the Rocky Mountain foothills. A person has gone missing, and a search team is out looking to see what may have happened. The men lowered their gaze and inspected around their feet. Pine cones lay in melting snow. Prickly pear cacti poked through soil of decomposing granite. Deer droppings littered the ground like piles of milk duds. It was then that one of the searchers pointed beneath a juniper. "We found him," the young man said. Steve Shelifo approached through crunching snow, and as he neared, his eyes widened in disbelief. "None of us were prepared for what we found," he said later, "not in the remotest sense." During his years in wilderness rescue, Steve had seen plenty of corpses, dismembered in plane crashes, bloated from drowning, crumpled after falling from cliffs. But this sight was more than gruesome. It was both haunting and indescribably weird. The body, clothed in athletic gear, wasn't sloppily mangled. It was carefully carved, hollowed out like a pumpkin. Someone had cut a circle from the front of the sweatshirt and the turquoise T-shirt beneath, sliced through the skin and bones, exposed the chest cavity, and plucked out the organs. After conducting this ghoulish backwoods surgery, the killer had removed his victim's face and then sprinkled moss and twigs on the lower torso as if to signify something profound, as if performing a macabre ritual. "Is the murderer still on the mountain?" Steve wondered. Then, urgently and cryptically, one of the other searchers said, "Hey, right behind you." Steve turned, fearing a madman with a shotgun. Instead, he saw a wild animal.
And that animal is at the heart of this story.
Right.
And that animal is?
It is a mountain lion, also known as a cougar or a puma. Basically, the United States' largest cat. Mountain lions can grow to be well over 100 pounds, and This mountain lion was the first to have killed an adult human being in North America in more than 100 years. And my book basically looks at what led that mountain lion to cause this tragedy.
There seems to be a change of behavior in the mountain lions. And can you tell us what that is about?
Right. Well, prior to the death that I write about in 1991, if you had asked a wildlife biologist to describe mountain lion behavior, they would have told you mountain lions are timid, they are elusive, you'll never see them. They avoid people, they avoid cities, they're nocturnal, mm-hmm. they're out hunting at night. Yet what happened in Colorado and what we're seeing increasingly is they're out in the daytime walking through suburbia, not running away from people, and increasingly are on occasion seeing people as prey. And that's something that, again, the naturalist 50 or 100 years ago would have said was ridiculous. Teddy Roosevelt, who hunted cougars and was really quite a naturalist and conservationist, once wrote that there's no more fear of sleeping in a forest filled with cougars than if they were so many tomcats, is what he said. He basically thought they were harmless.
There seems to be a real documented shift in the sightings that folks used to, you know, see them mostly at night, and that really has completely shifted.
Right. There were two biologists who were studying mountain lion behavior in this very area, and they were documenting a growing number of sightings of mountain lions, and they were seeing a change in the behavior, that as the mountain lions adapted to this new landscape, this new suburban landscape, the lions were creeping closer and closer to town, showing up more and more in the daytime, and were increasingly not running away from people when they saw people. The lions were, the term is habituating, they were mm-hmm. habituating to people. They did not have that fear we tend to think that most wildlife is supposed to have of us.
Now, you use a term called the ecotone. What is the ecotone?
An ecotone is a boundary between two habitats. So basically, an ecotone could be the edge between a forest and a meadow. Part of what I write about is this new sort of ecotone that we've created in America, which is an ecotone between urban America and wild America. We now have this very sharp edge that you can drive down the highway just about anywhere, and you can see it, where the homes are sprawling outward, and there's a sharp edge then where the forest begins, or out west where the mountains begin. And that edge is where we're having new sorts of troubling dynamics between the people on one side and the animals on the other coming together along that boundary.
Now, I know that some folks think that the deer have lost their natural predators, the mountain lions or the panthers in this area, and some folks are hoping that they can be reestablished.
They are headed this way. I mean, they are moving east across the plains right now. Just in the last few years, they have clearly reestablished themselves in Iowa, in Missouri. Right now, there are lots of reports of a mountain lion that appears to be in the suburbs of Chicago. So they're creeping eastward, and as they're coming east, they're finding plenty of deer to eat, which is their favorite food, and a lot more habitat than you'd think, I mean, because a lot of the forests have come back. So I think they probably will get back to western Pennsylvania on their own. It may take a couple of decades, but unless we purposely try to stop them, and I don't think there's any plan to do that, I think they could get back here on their own.
Well, I really appreciate your having the opportunity to come down here. And before we go, I'd like to ask you, what are the core lessons that we can learn from this modern parable?
I've come to the conclusion that, in essence, being nice to wildlife is not ultimately the right way to behave. If you love wildlife, you should not be feeding wildlife. In fact, I think we should be scaring the animals from our yards, because what's happening is the animals are getting too comfortable with us. They're becoming destructive to us, and it's ultimately destructive to them. I think we need to reestablish kind of a respect on both sides of this ecotone so that, if we want to live with the animals, they need to keep some distance from us. And that's going to be particularly true when the predators get back to this part of the country. We don't want them to get so comfortable in our backyards.
The book is called The Beast in the Garden. Author David Barron gives us a modern parable of man and nature. Thank you very much for stopping by the Allegheny Front.
Matthew, it was my pleasure.
You're listening to The Allegheny Front. I'm Matthew Craig. Our thanks go out to the Heinz Endowment, the Catherine Mavis McKenna Foundation, and WYEP for their continuing support. And thank you for being with us. And now, flying in like a long-lost bird, almost forgotten by the masses, but never forsaken by those who love to hear sweet mating songs, is our own ivory-billed naturalist, Chuck Welsh. Welcome, Chuck.
Thanks, Matthew.
Now, I hear there's some big news in the naturalist world this week.
Yes, there is. There's been confirmation of the sightings of some ivory-billed woodpeckers.
Wow. Now, were you one of the naturalists that was down there doing the confirmation and sightings?
No, unfortunately not.
So now tell us, what is all the fuss about?
Well, the last confirmed sighting was in North America was in about 1944. And after a bird hasn't been seen or heard for about 50 years, they pretty much put it on the extinction list.
So they were just sort of hiding then? Is that what was happening?
Something like that.
Okay. Now, who officially made that determination that they are now not extinct?
Well, conservation organizations such as the Audubon Society and research facilities such as the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology, they'll call in all the biggest birder experts in the country. In fact, one of the country's best birders is right from Powder Mill Nature Reserve in Westmoreland County, Mike Lanzone, and he was one of the confirmers.
Okay.
And they do. These characters don't tend to rush into things. They surveyed the place for about 14 months and came up with 7 confirmed sightings.
Wow, 14 months then, okay. So are there any pictures or recordings that they got of the ivory-billed woodpecker?
Yes, but none of the recordings have really been made public yet. But if you do go on the internet, do a Google search, you can find some really rough video of some things that somebody shot.
Wow, okay. Now, the decline that I understand of the population was due to the destruction of the habitat. Now, what type of habitat do they prefer?
Well, they prefer old-growth forests with hardwood trees, especially cypress trees, in swampy areas. And just like other woodpeckers, they do like dead trees, but they're a little more fussy. They like trees that haven't been dead very long. These trees are still full of enough nutrients to support their favorite food, beetle larvae. As you know, after a tree stands for a very long time, it dries out, eventually dies, and usually falls over. And the only animals that will be interested in that would be termites and carpenter ants.
Now, the birds are actually quite large, aren't they?
Yes, they are. They're about 18 to 20 inches long with a wingspan that can approach about 3 feet. They're striking birds, too. They're black and white, and as the name states, they've got an ivory-colored bill.
Now, Chuck, have these birds ever been found in western Pennsylvania?
No, their range is in the southeast, maybe as far north as North Carolina and possibly as far west as parts of Texas.
Okay, but we do have a similar-looking bird around here, don't we?
Yes, we have the pileated woodpecker. In fact, Walter Lance used the ivory-billed woodpecker and the pileated woodpecker as models for his Woody Woodpecker of cartoon fame.
Now, can you do the Woody Woodpecker call?
No, but maybe we can play one.
Hey, you never know. Tim might have something up his sleeve there. So the conservationists must be reeling with the news of the survival of the ivory-billed woodpecker.
They sure are. We're hoping that this can be used as fuel to ignite more conservation efforts within the Bush administration.
So while speaking of conservation efforts, what birds are of interest here in western Pennsylvania?
Well, there's a similar story, not to that extreme, however, in western PA of the barn owl. In fact, in eastern United States in general, loss of habitat. When we develop farmland, they have no more place to hunt. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like I said, this is going to be great news for conservationists all over. It hopefully should alert the government that, hey, something's up.
Yeah, they need to build more barns.
That's true.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much. That's our own intrepid naturalist, Chuck Walsh.
Thanks,
thank
Matthew.
Guess who?
This is Doug Oster from the Allegheny Front, and I'm here with our organic gardener, Jessica Walliser. Hi, Jessica. How are
Hi,
you?
Hi, Doug. Good. How are you?
And she is going to answer the number one gardening question in the world.
In the history of gardening.
In the history
questions.
Of gardening. And it's all about hydrangeas. When do we prune them? Should we prune them? How do we make them bloom right? Are we supposed to cut them to the ground?
I thought it was just one question, Doug.
No one knows what to do.
Yeah. Well, and you know, this is a perfect topic for May, because May is usually the time when I recommend that people prune their hydrangeas. Now, the hydrangeas that I am speaking of are the hydrangea macrophylla, which are the big traditional blue and pink flowered hydrangea. Some of the white ones, like Annabelle and hydrangea paniculata, or the PG hydrangea, their pruning is a little bit different. But the big traditional old-fashioned hydrangeas should all be pruned usually in May.
Okay. But aren't the buds on there from the winter before?
The deal with it is, you know, they look like dead twigs, right?
Right, right?
Most people come out in the spring, they see their dead twigs, they leaf out really late, so they go and they cut all of those dead twigs back to the ground. Hydrangea macrophylla blooms on old wood. It blooms on last year's growth. So if you cut all those brown stems down to the ground, you're cutting off your flower buds for this year. So what you want to do is you want to wait until May, when they start to develop little green buds on the sides of those what appear to be dead twigs. And you're going to want to cut only the tip of that brown stem off, just down to where the top two buds are emerging from the stem.
Okay. Well, that's good advice, because so many people think you're supposed to just cut the thing to the ground and you're cutting your flowers off.
Right, exactly. And that way you can really encourage it to get bigger and better every year, instead of really staying the same size from year to year. It's okay to go out real early in the season and clear away the leaves that have collected at the base and, you know, get the mulch around the roots a little bit. But don't do your heavy pruning until it starts to leaf out, so that you know how far back to take it.
Now tell me a little bit about the new hydrangeas, like an endless summer, something like that. Do we treat that differently?
If they are hydrangea macrophylla, check the botanical name of it. If their species is macrophylla, they will bloom on old wood. So it's important to know the botanical name of the variety that you're looking at. If it's hydrangea paniculata grandiflora or some of the other hydrangeas, those are pruned very differently, and you might want to get yourself a good pruning book that deals with specific species so that you can check it as a reference guide and know exactly the proper way to prune them.
Now, what else for a plant like that to keep it growing and keep it blooming? Anything else we need to do?
Well, compost, of course. Mulching it with compost will add nutrients as the compost breaks down over the coming year, and it will also help stabilize the soil temperatures and keep the weeds down from around it.
And how do I get the color of bloom that I want?
Well, that's, of course, dependent on the alkalinity of the soil level. So have your soil tested, and then whatever color you want, either add lime or sulfur to it to get it to change colors.
Do you know what to add to what to get what color? Because I don't.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure, and oh gosh, this is going to get me in trouble if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that basic soil or alkaline soil will make the blue, and acidic soils will make it red or more pink.
Well, we know for sure it's either that or the exact opposite.
Right, exactly. So there would be another cause for a good reference guide.
And let's say somebody just buys a hydrangea. Where should we plant it?
They generally like dappled partial shade. Their leaves tend to get a little crispy if we have them in full sun, and the flowers will fade really, really quickly if they're placed in full sun. So try to put them in a good half day of shade, especially in the afternoon. They like to have a little bit more shade, and just dappled under a deciduous tree is really the best location for them.
Well, that's great. And to get blooms in July and June from a plant like that is just absolutely wonderful.
And they're great for cutting and drying, and just they just make fabulous bouquets.
I'm Doug Oster.
And Jessica Walliser.
For the Allegheny Front.
Thanks for being with us here at the Allegheny Front. If you had something you'd like to share with us, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is info@alleghenyfront.org. You can also reach us by snail mail. The address is 2313 East Carson Street, Pittsburgh, PA 15203. Kathy Naur is our executive producer, Tim Prevost is our technical director, and Tim also wrote and performed our theme music. Our programs are archived and available on WYEP.org. I'm Matthew Craig. Hope you can join us again next Wednesday evening at 7 or Saturday morning at 6:30 for another edition of the Allegheny Front. Until then, go well with good blessings.